Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Yesterday, President Obama gave a press conference about ISIL. He said, quote, "We'll keep hitting them and pushing them back and driving them out." In other words, ISIL turns out not to be invincible. They are, in fact, inevitably going to be defeated. End quote. After the press conference, the White House press corps asked a few questions, a few throwaway questions about Donald Trump, and a few predictable questions about ISIS. But where are the questions about how we got here, or why the administration believes that even more airstrikes, drones, and attacks will lead to a different outcome? Today, we are joined by Mark Danner. He's joining us to discuss these issues. He's a veteran journalist who has reported on politics and foreign affairs for more than three decades. Mark has covered wars and political conflict in Latin America, Haiti, the Balkans, and the Middle East. Mark is professor of journalism at UC Berkeley and the author of several books, including his most recent, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. And Mark Danner joins us in studio. Hi, Mark. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, good to be here. It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we like to highlight journalism that really stood out. So what did you see this week that caught your eye?
Well, there was a really excellent piece in the New York Times by their terror correspondent, Rachmini Kalamaki, who did a piece about the organization of foreign sleeper cells for the Islamic State. It relied on an enormous amount of reporting, including interviews with various people who were in prison, including one, a Maine fellow who was in prison in Germany, talking about how these foreign agents were organized, how this particular fellow showed up in Syria wanting to join the Islamic State, and was told, you know what, we want you to stay in Germany, where now we have enough people here fighting in Syria and fighting in Iraq. What we want to do is organize people abroad to carry out attacks there. And it was a highly revealing piece about how this was organized over the last couple of years, relied on an awful lot of in-depth reporting and access to a lot of secret documents. Very, very good piece and very revealing piece about how well organized and intelligent the Islamic State is, how these sleeper cell attacks really were planned a couple of years ago continue, obviously, to be happening around the world.
So kudos to Rachmini Kalamaki,
yes,
with the New York Times. And since you brought up the story, can you talk about what is involved in actually reporting on ISIS now that they are in Kabul, Baghdad, Brussels, and Libya? The U.S. started bombing Libya. What is it take to actually report on ISIS?
Well, first of all, ISIS is such a large phenomenon that, you know, it's like reporting on the Pentagon, mm-hmm, or something. I mean, in fact, it's much more complicated, of course, because it's in 20 or so countries, as you point out. It has a large chunk of territory that straddles the Iraq-Syria border. So it's, on the one hand, an intelligence story, because they have various sleeper cells, various secret organizations in countries throughout the Middle East and South Asia. It's also reporting on a quasi-country or a para-state, which exists. You can either be reporting on that from Baghdad, from Iraq, or more dangerously and more difficultly, from Syria, because it does have the characteristics of an actual state as well. Partly you are dependent, as this piece that I'm talking about was, on sources within the intelligence community. She benefited clearly from a lot of leaked documents that came from various intelligence services. Partly you can do some of the reporting on the ground if you want to. For example, you can embed yourself in American forces or Iraqi forces in Iraq. They recently retook Fallujah. There's an operation that's beginning now, beginning to be organized, that is probably slated for sometime in the fall, in which the Iraqi army, various militias, and American advisors will try to retake the city of Fallujah, the city of Mosul, which is the second largest in Iraq. So that's more of a war type correspondence story, but there is the intelligence side of it as well. I mean, they are a parastate, but they also have this foreign terrorist capability, which is really like their strategic weapon. It's kind of like our Air Force or our Navy. And you see that as they're starting to lose ground, and President Obama pointed this out yesterday, as they're losing ground in Iraq and Syria, they're reverting more to terrorist attacks abroad to keep up the impression that they're still winning, to keep up their international profile, to keep the flow of recruits coming, and so on. So the terrorist side of them is extremely important. It's becoming more so, paradoxically, as they're losing ground, which is one of the things that casts doubt on President Obama's assertion that they will be defeated. I mean, the question is, with a group like this, and again, this goes back to your reporting question, what would it be to defeat them? How do you defeat them? I mean, if indeed they lose every square mile of territory they occupy in Iraq and Syria, they then revert to their franchises around the world and also to their virtual reality, where they have this enormous presence online as a kind of recruiting mechanism for an ideology. And I think one of the errors we've made in prosecuting the so-called war on terror over the last 15 years is we've increased, through our actions, the will of various young people to support these organizations, which is really, at the end of the day, their essence, you know, this dispersed will among people to support them. And they will, if they lose all their territorial, they will revert back into the will of their supporters, in effect.
You brought up a number of things there. You said that they're losing ground. Why is that happening?
Well, you have various forces from several directions fighting them. They've essentially opened a 3- or 4-front war. First of all, the Iraqi state is fighting them within Iraq, and that includes not only the Iraqi army, some units of which do function, but also Iranian-backed, largely Shiite militias, which are fighting them on Iraqi territory. And they're pushing into Anbar province, which is western Iraq, Sunni sections of western Iraq, and north as well. The Kurds from the northern direction are also fighting them, both in Iraq and in Syria. And then various forces within Syria are fighting them as well as the United States in the form of airstrikes, which indeed are continuing every day, drone strikes, which are continuing not every day but frequently, and the use of not only Americans as military advisors but also special operators, which we don't know much about that, about what the Americans are doing, but they are indeed involved. So there are a lot of forces fighting against them from various directions. And their territory is gradually shrinking as a result. I mean, they've lost a great deal of territory within Iraq and significant amounts of territory within Syria. And it's an open secret, as I said, that there'll be an offensive sometime during the fall, this coming fall, against Mosul in Iraq. And there's also military activity that seems to be directed at cutting off Raqqa, which is the city in Syria, which is their de facto capital. That's being increasingly isolated by attacks from various Syrian forces.
ISIS has almost taken the place of al-Qaeda in the news.
Mm-hmm.
The media throws the word ISIS around constantly without giving much context.
That's true.
And I wonder, in your book, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War, you write about how President Obama often says we need to look forward and not back. And you argue, no, we mm-hmm. have to look back. And I want to ask you, how often do you hear reporters, and how important is it to talk about the history of ISIS and why it was created in the first place? Terry Gross had on New York Times Baghdad bureau chief Tim Arango earlier this year, and it really struck me because I hardly ever hear this asked. She said, do you think that ISIS would have existed if not for the American invasion of Iraq? And Tim Arango of the New York Times said, no, absolutely not. We just don't hear that much in the media.
No, it's true. And one of the problems is the press, and particularly newspapers, but the press in general is bad when it comes to history. In general, it's about daily news. The amount of context is severely limited. It's rare that you have a historical discussion in the press. And, of course, the problem with that is with a lot of phenomena that are very important, the context, the roots, the history is absolutely essential to understanding them. And that is certainly true when it comes to the Islamic State or ISIS. ISIS really began in the summer of 2003 after the Americans had occupied Baghdad. It was started by a man named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who had actually become an international superstar when his name was mentioned during the February 5th, 2003 address to the United Nations by Secretary of State Colin Powell. He went to the UN to support the Iraq War, the invasion of Iraq, and he talked about Zarqawi as a major figure in Iraq who was supporting terrorism. I mean, for a lot of reasons that aren't worth going into now, it was a very distorted description of Zarqawi, but it made him an international figure. So, in effect, even before the group grew, the United States was responsible in the person of its Secretary of State of making Zarqawi its leader and international superstar when it came to terrorism. In the summer of 2003, there were a series of enormous car bombings in Iraq. These were the signal, really, that the insurgency had gotten underway. First, the Jordanian embassy was attacked with a car bomb, killing around 20 people. Then the UN compound, the so-called Canal Hotel, was attacked with a car bomb, truck bomb, a big truck bomb that killed, I think, 23 people, if I'm not mistaken, including the UN envoy, a very influential diplomat named Sergio de Mello. And then finally, the Grand Mosque in Najaf was attacked, killing the Ayatollah that would probably, or excuse me, the cleric who would have become probably Iraq's first post-invasion, post-occupation president. That truck bomb killed, I think, 105 people. We hadn't seen terrorist attacks on this scale before. I mean, it was this new thing. And no one really knew where they were coming from, but it turned out they were coming from a group that soon called itself Al-Qaeda in Iraq, led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And they followed a strategy from then on of attacking Shia. They were a Sunni group that essentially played on the sectarian divide within Iraq, increased that divide, attacked Shia so as to provoke them. This is the strategy of provocation, which I talk about in the book, to provoke the Shia to strike back at the Sunni. And their idea was, we're going to build our Sunni organization by provoking the Shia to attack Sunni, and Sunnis will eventually have to join us. And they continued to carry out this astonishing campaign of terrorism that at its height was killing 3,000, 3,200, something like that, Iraqis every month. I mean, it was incredibly bloody and terrorist attacks that were killing 100, regularly killing 80, 90, 100 people. We saw a terrorist attack in Baghdad in July last month that killed, the numbers are still not certain, but probably 340 people. I mean, these are just the carnage is really unimaginable. So it is just simply a historical fact that the Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, whatever you'd like to call them, arose during the occupation, the early occupation of Iraq by the Americans. And you see now that the Republicans, and particularly Donald Trump, are saying that ISIS was created by Hillary Clinton, which, you know, it's common in political campaigns to get distortions. But that simply has no factual basis at all. I mean, nothing. It's a complete lie. But I think this history is absolutely critical for understanding what's going on now, because in effect, over the last 15 years, and I argue this in Spiral, our policy steps, one after the other, have absolutely grown the terrorist threat. They have increased the number of jihadists. They have increased the number of jihadi groups. And this is one of the constants of the war on terror, that we have, through our actions, through the United States' actions, actually increased the threat substantially. And ISIS is a very good example of this. ISIS, indeed, as Tim Marango said to Terry Gross, would not have existed without the American invasion of Iraq.
Today we are speaking with Mark Danner about his new book, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. He is a veteran journalist who has reported on foreign affairs and politics for more than three decades. He's reported from Latin America, Haiti, the Balkans, and the Middle East. And today we are talking about media coverage of endless war. We don't really hear much about that in the media. We're also talking about media coverage of ISIS. What questions do you have about the coverage you have seen of these issues? President Obama gave a press conference about it yesterday, and he wasn't really asked that many, I have to say, interesting questions about this issue. So what are your thoughts about that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Mark, if you had been at that press conference yesterday, what would you have asked the president?
Well, I think, actually, as you said, Rose, an obvious question would have been, why do we believe that doing precisely the same thing that we've done over 15 years, a period during which the terrorist threat has grown exponentially, why do we think by doing the same things will this threat begin to subside and go away, when in fact what we've done thus far has grown it and inflated it? And I think, you know, it's odd. Basically, the press, the news media, exists in a kind of particular time warp in which what counts is the day's news. What counts is what's happening immediately, which is one of the reasons why you had all these Trump questions yesterday. Mm-hmm. And the war on terror has become the kind of background to our lives, to the extent that it's almost difficult to notice it. We notice it when there's a terrorist attack. But in fact, the war, such as it is, goes on day after day after day. And those attacks are conceived of by the Islamic State and other organizations as responses by attacks from the West and from the United States. So they see this as an ongoing conflict in which they strike blows and we strike blows. We see it as a series of irrational and impossible to understand acts of terror that come out of nowhere. Mm. We have no historical context when it comes to the war on terror, I'd argue. So I would have asked a broader question just about the strategy of the war on terror. You know, there's an interesting statistic that comes, that I quote in Spiral, that comes from the Secretary of State's statistics on worldwide terrorism. It says that in 2002, the year after the 9/11 attacks, there were 772 terrorist attacks worldwide. Last year, there were just under 33,000.
Wow.
Which means the increase is about 4,000%. So in fact, if you have any kind of objective standard, if the war is about reducing terrorism and reducing the number of attacks, it has been an abject failure. Which you would think might lead people to question it. You know, why is it a failure? Why is the number of jihadi groups and the number of jihadists growing? Why are these people, you see young people around the world, sympathetic to the jihadi cause? I mean, it's a vanishingly tiny percentage of the population. That's true. And very often these people, the so-called lone wolves, are disturbed in various ways. They're alienated and so on. But in fact, the number who are sympathetic seems to be growing. And I think one question is, why is this happening and what can we do about it? I think Obama actually, and one should say this, that commendably he's fairly reliably a realist when it comes to these matters. I mean, he doesn't say we're going to eliminate all terrorist attacks. He said we can indeed defeat this group, but the attacks probably will continue. And I think that's true. And, you know, I've been very apprehensive about possibly a series of attacks coming on American soil in the fall, just because the American election is kind of this ripe fruit for the Islamic State, something that they can influence. Al-Qaeda did this in 2004 and attacking the Atocha train station in Madrid. And they actually caused the current Spanish prime minister to lose the election and the Spanish forces to be pulled out of Iraq. I mean, it was this amazing operation in which a terrorist attack actually dominated Spanish politics. And I am apprehensive that you might have a similar attack or series of attacks in the fall intended to influence our election.
That's pretty frightening to think about.
It is. I'm laughing because frightening is a very good word for it. I should emphasize that I have no evidence
that
going to happen. None at all. Just that if you read some of the ideology of the Islamic State, and it's out there, you can read this. There's a particularly interesting book called The Management of Savagery by Abu Bakr al-Naji. That's a pseudonym. We don't really know who that is. But it seems to be the kind of ideological manual of the Islamic State. It can be found online very easily. There's a translation that Harvard did. And one of the key arguments of this ideology is you have to provoke the United States to stop fighting through surrogates and to attack directly. In other words, you want to get American troops into the Middle East. You want to have a reintroduction of a kind of hundreds of thousands of troops. And this suggests to me that you would want to strike the United States directly. I also think that it would be obviously in their interest, the Islamic State interest, to have a President Trump, I think, who could be expected to be much more aggressive in fighting them. And they want aggressiveness.
Can you talk more about what they want? Because that doesn't get much attention either.
Sure. Well, let's start with al-Qaeda. You know, people think of the 9/11 attacks and they essentially, you know, if you say what was al-Qaeda trying to achieve, you know, the obvious answer seems to be to kill a lot of Americans. And they did that. But we also know through a lot of documents that what they wanted to achieve was to provoke the United States into invading a Muslim country. In other words, al-Qaeda, when they look at – if you look at their ideology, what they want to do is overthrow the so-called apostate regimes in the Arab world and in the Islamic world and install in their place a caliphate. The apostate regimes, for example, at the time, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia, which is still obviously ruling, they look at these regimes and they say they exist because they're allied to the United States. The U.S. gives Egypt $2 to $3 billion a year in aid. How can we overthrow the Mubarak regime in Egypt? How can we do it? Well, they began by fighting them directly, but you had this vicious response from the security services in Egypt. They couldn't overthrow them. Well, we can attack the United States, which is in a sense attacking the puppet master, cutting the strings to the puppet, and the regime will then fall. So our idea in attacking the United States is to essentially overthrow these local regimes. How do we do that? We get the United States to show that it's really the repressor of Muslims. We get them to actually show that they are repressing Muslims directly, not doing it through Hosni Mubarak. So we attack the United States. The United States invades, say, Afghanistan, and we get pictures every day of the U.S. killing Muslims. And that will help grow our movement. It will show people that America is the enemy. It will arouse the Islamic world. It will arouse Muslims. So the United States responded, of course, by bombing Afghanistan, but not really invading immediately, but by giving a much larger gift, by invading Iraq. Mm-hmm. And the invasion of Iraq provided this ongoing telegenic imagery of American tanks rumbling through the streets of a major Arab capital, of American soldiers throwing Muslims on their faces on the ground, putting their boots, military boots, on their backs, throwing them into prison, and then, of course, torturing them in Abu Ghraib. These amazingly useful images of Americans torturing Muslims that were simply tailor-made for al-Qaeda's ideology. So this was a cardinal example of the strategy of provocation. You attack the great power. You're weak. You're a small group. I mean, al-Qaeda was maybe 1,000 militants or a few hundred. Wow. You attack a country of 315 million, since you don't have an army, you use the army of your opponent, of your adversary. And in fact, that's what they did. So the U.S. invaded Iraq, and it helped them dramatically grow their movement, including it helped them spring to life a new group called at the time Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is now the Islamic State. So if 15 years after 9/11, there's not one multinational terrorist group that has offices around the world and is dedicated to fighting the United States, but two of them, the U.S., I would argue, is very much to blame for that.
So now we have these horrific attacks and we have this horrible refugee crisis, people fleeing so many countries. Mm-hmm. This is so hard to know, but Mark, because you report on these issues so deeply, do you think that we would be where we are today if the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq?
No, I don't. I think that there's another aspect of the Iraq invasion, which is that the Bush administration talked about before the invasion the idea of creative chaos, creative destabilization, going into the Middle East and busting it up, essentially. Right. The idea was that you would have this kind of domino effect where countries that were autocracies would become representative, much more stable governments. This is what some of the ideologists of the Bush administration argued. And I would say you've had, indeed, creative destabilization, but the destabilization has gone in the opposite direction. You've had now, you have really four wars going on in the Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. And this is this broad destabilization that's happened in the wake of the Iraq war. So, you know, I think the United States, in some sense, achieved what it set out to achieve. It's just the Bush administration ideologists had this idea that it would be like Eastern Europe. You know, you would have these governments emerging from communism, which would be representative and allies of the U.S. and so on. And in fact, you've had the opposite happen. You've had a kind of destabilization that has created a series of what the Pentagon now somewhat poetically calls ungoverned spaces. And ungoverned spaces are real targets of opportunity for jihadist groups. And we've seen that in Libya, where we're now bombing, of course. We've seen that in Yemen. We've seen that in various other places, that once you destabilize a place, this is where jihadist groups try to colonize next, and that's indeed what has happened. So the U.S. has had a dramatic effect on the Middle East over the last 15 years. I would just argue it's not been a positive one.
Mark Danner is a veteran journalist who is the author of several books. His most recent is Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say. I'm sorry, it's Inflection Point on Fridays here on KLW at 11 o'clock. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Michael Denzel Smith. He'll be talking about his new book, Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. He writes that his father's proudest memory was voting for President Obama. At the same time, many young black men are being shot and don't make it to age 25. So he asks, how do you learn to be a black man in today's society? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are discussing coverage of endless war and ISIS with Mark Danner. He is a veteran journalist who has covered these issues for three decades from Latin America, Haiti, the Balkans, and the Middle East. He is professor of journalism at UC Berkeley. He also teaches at Bard College, and he's the author of several books. books. His most recent is Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can email feedback at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. And let's hear from Dave in Berkeley. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show. Hello, Dave. Dave had a question, well, I don't know his whole question, about war profiteers and what role that plays in all of this.
Well, I think war is good for a lot of businesses. There's no question about it. It's very profitable. And there were indeed a lot of companies that made a lot of money, particularly with the invasion of Iraq. The cost of the invasion is now estimated to be in the trillions, low trillions of dollars, and that money went somewhere. On the other hand, I'm always skeptical that this is kind of what causes wars. You know, wars are caused at the policy level. It is true that there are various interests that play a part in bringing on a war, and the fact that it's good for business is one of them, there's no question. But I think a larger influence is the influence of national security bureaucracies. I think after September 11th, I think there was almost a degree of frustration. I mean, it's kind of hard to describe this in precise terms, but the United States was enjoying at the time, as the neoconservatives called it, a unipolar moment. That is, it was the one great power in the world. The Soviet Union had disappeared. The U.S. had by far the largest military, you know, funded to the degree of bigger than – more funding than the next 10 militaries in the world combined. So why can't we use it? We should be able to win this war by using this military. And I think there was a sense in which the U.S., it was time after this kind of terrorist attack to strike deep into the heart of the Middle East and use the strength that we had. And I think this is an important theme in recent U.S. history, that because the country has this all-powerful military, or it's thought to be all-powerful, let's use it. Let's use it as a policy tool. And the problem is, I think, that our military, and most militaries, this is true of, is very good at destroying things. It's good at taking down a regime, at destroying a regime, at bombing a capital, at destroying an opposing army, and so on. But it is terrible at installing a new order to replace it. And Iraq is a great example of that, that, you know, in essence, the U.S. Army was in Baghdad in a matter of weeks. But in fact, it set loose this kind of Pandora box of insurgency, counterinsurgency, terrorism, you name it. And the U.S. military was completely powerless to do anything about it. And consequently, we lost that war. It's, I think, good to say that forthrightly, that the U.S. has fought these wars since September 11th, and it has uniformly lost them. The Afghan war, I think, cannot be described as a victory. The Iraq war certainly can't. And I think it would be useful if this caused citizens of the country, policymakers of the country, to question our assumptions when it comes to the use of American power, that very often the use of organized violence leads to greater instability and greater problems for the United States. And you mentioned earlier, Rose, the refugee flows, I mean, which is a great example of that. You know, we're seeing the destabilization of Europe, really, I would say, as a consequence of the wars that we launched in the Middle East. I mean, we took a problem that was horrifying but very contained. You know, al-Qaeda was a few thousand militants, as I mentioned, in the mountains of Afghanistan, and made it into a worldwide cause of destabilization.
Well, and you talk about young people who are easily influenced. And I think about these young people who are leaving their home countries and they get separated from their families. I mean, some young boys are ending up in Greece without any family, and they have to sell themselves in parks to buy food. PBS actually has been doing really good reporting. I forgot the correspondent's name. I want to get him on the show. I'll have to find it. But he has been doing reporting from boats, where they go out with these international organizations and they try to rescue people. Half of the people in the boat are dead by the time they get there. People leaving from Libya I mean, it's just devastating. There's this whole young generation that is fleeing, and they end up somewhere without any family members. What's going to happen to these people?
Yeah, it's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And it causes, needless to say, greater destabilization within the countries of Europe as well. And, you know, it also fits in, it should be said, to the theory of the Islamic State. They talk about eliminating the gray zone. And what they mean by that is there's a zone of people who, politically speaking, have not taken sides when it comes to the Islamic State, when it comes to what's going on in the Middle East, and they want to eliminate that. And how do you do that? Well, you destabilize by means of terrorist attacks, by means of refugees and so on, a country like France, in which the terrorist attack causes an uprising of right-wing political sentiment, which causes more repressive laws that Muslims believe to be repressive, more discrimination against Muslims, and thus a greater flow of young people toward ISIS, or at least sympathetic towards ISIS and other jihadi groups. So you're trying to do that. I mean, you want right-wing powers or someone in the United States who backs closing the borders to Muslims. I mean, very similar. Eliminate the gray zone. And this is exactly what they're trying to do. I mean, you just have to read, and I would suggest to your listeners who are interested in this issue, the Islamic State has a very slick, very well-produced magazine called Dabiq, in which all of this stuff is set out. You know, it's in English and various other languages. You can get it online, and you can read exactly what they're trying to do. It's all set out in very lucid, very well-written terms. So we've created a kind of feedback loop when it comes to the politics in the so-called home countries that is indeed increasing recruitment.
Well, that PBS correspondent who does excellent work on the refugee crisis, his name is Malcolm Brabant, B-R-A-B-A-N-T. I always look for his pieces because they're so – he's doing some of the best reporting.
Yeah, superb. I agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we've got a number of phone calls. We're speaking today with Mark Danner, author of Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. Let's hear from Art in San Francisco. Hi, Art. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose, and hi, Mark. Great discussion. I'd like to hear so much more of this. I wish more people around the country could hear this kind of thinking and get more perspective instead of being caught up in the kind of the caveman hitting back kind of mentality that seems to, as you discussed earlier in the hour, doom us to more and more things that are lead to violence and terrorism. So I'd like to, you know, sort of go away from the policy area of, you know, foreign policy to a discussion of how can we enlarge the audience in the United States, and during election year, we have a great opportunity to do so, for this kind of perspective where we step back and look at maybe the causes of the violence we're seeing in the world as opposed to the problem of the day being discussed.
Well, that's a profound question, and Rose and I are smiling at one another, a deeply frustrating one, because we began the discussion by talking about how newspapers and the daily media are not the place to get historical context, unfortunately. And I would say that's true in spades of election campaigns. I mean, it's fascinating seeing the response after attacks by the candidates. You know, you saw Donald Trump after the Orlando attack essentially come on very strong and saying, we have to strike back, we have to hit back, we have to do something, we have to hit them hard. And Hillary Clinton essentially said, we have to continue what we're doing, we have to be methodical, we have to fight the Islamic State, we have to build up our defenses, we have to. And it was a great example of what works politically and what doesn't. You want to strike. I mean, terrorism strikes at our lizard brains, as it were. It's terror. It's fear. And the person who responds by saying, let's kill them, let's go get them, let's clean them out, let's destroy them, we'll destroy them so fast, which is Trump, has, I think, an automatic advantage in that response, because people want that kind of lizard brain reaction. They want to be told they'll be safe. They want a leader who's strong. And I think Trump very much appreciates that. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, is methodical. She's slow. She's can discuss this in policy terms very rationally. And there is a degree of disadvantage in taking that approach. Now, I'm not saying by any means that everybody responds to Trump. And I think recent developments are showing that, that the Clinton campaign is succeeding in casting him as unworthy for office, essentially, as too unstable. In fact, he's doing he's helping them a lot in making that argument. But it's clear that he has early on grasped that one of the ways for him to take office, to win the election, would be to seize on the fear of the public. And if you look at his convention speech, if you look at other things he said publicly, I talk about this in a cover piece I did on Trump for the New York Review a couple of months ago, you see that he perceives that the strongman approach is one way for him to win. And indeed, that's a characteristic of terrorism. Terrorism creates fear. Terrorism creates terror. And not only the terrorists benefit from it, politicians who are willing to surf fear for votes, that's a phrase from Senator Claire McCaskill, benefit from it as well. And the Bush administration benefited from it, too, in the time after 9/11. I mean, they won the 2002 midterm elections. So I think that, unfortunately, you know, to get back to Art's question, it's a very difficult time to have a clear discussion of real policy when it comes to terrorism and the war on terror. I mean, I wrote this book. Partly the idea was to get it out in the middle of the election campaign to help promote this kind of discussion. And, you know, I'd love to have discussions of the sort we're having today. But the fact is that it has not occupied center stage. This kind of discussion, I don't mean the book, but this kind of discussion has not occupied center stage when it comes to our public political debates. And that's a little surprising in a way.
Over the last 6 to 8 months, when we have authors come on talking about really serious issues like this, about money and politics, you name it, I always ask them, did you get an invite from the cable shows? And so many authors say no or yes, but then I got bumped because Donald Trump held a press conference.
That's right.
What about you?
No, I in fact, I think the publicist was told this, that we're kind of on deck for all Trump all the time.
Wow.
And, you know, it's an interesting, you and I talked about this. I mean, this shows we're talking about journalism here, and it's an interesting fact about journalism that we assume that decisions in the various, you know, editorial rooms when it comes to making decisions about what will go on a program that day, that those decisions are based on journalistic concerns. You know, what is the lead? That's the main journalistic question. But we've seen over the last year that particularly when it comes to the broadcast media and particularly television, the main question really has to do with what goose's ratings. You know, Trump, the New York Times famously published this analysis that Trump benefited during the primaries from $2 billion of free media. I don't know about that number. But the fact is that he's gotten vast amounts of free media because, this is no secret, because he dramatically raises ratings. Les Moonves, the head of CBS, said this very candidly, that, you know, Trump may not be good for the country, but he's really good for us. That's a slight paraphrase, but not much of one. And so this campaign has really shown kind of how our major journalistic broadcast institutions, in particular, make decisions. And, you know, showing this has not been pretty, I'm afraid.
Mark Danner is author of Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. Mark has been covering these issues for 3 decades, covering wars and politics in Latin America, Haiti, the Balkans, and the Middle East. And thank you for your call, Art. Let's go next from Eric, who is calling from Madrid. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Very much for your discussion. It's really wonderful to hear you, and I wish complex issues could be addressed more frequently on mainstream media. When you combine that with political rhetoric, it seems all impossible. Your comment also about, I think it was a reptile brain and Trump in the same sentence was very refreshing to hear. I just wanted to bring a little bit of attention to one remark you made with regard to the attacks in Madrid in 2004 and a popular misconception. You mentioned that it certainly led to the change of government from the conservative government to the socialist government under Zapatero. But it wasn't the tax directly that caused that change. It was the conservative government that was caught lying about those attacks.
Mm-hmm.
They had the opportunity to either tell the truth and say they weren't quite sure initially who led the attacks, or when evidence became apparent, to attribute it to Islamic terrorism, or to blame the traditional Spanish terrorist group, the Basque terrorist group, ETA. The Aznar government deliberately chose to blame the national terrorists, the ETA group, as an attempt to hide, basically, behind any potential linkage between their Iraq policy and the Islamic terrorism. It was because of that, and because they were caught red-handed doing this, that the election results ended up being what they were. But oftentimes it seems slightly misunderstood, the timeline of events around that election.
Thank you, Eric. I'm glad you for that clarification. And of course, they were caught, in a sense, red-handed, blaming ETA, and eventually had to go back on that and admit what the attack was. I remember it very well. I think the other thing to point out is that on the internet, for months before that attack, we had a document. I forget what it's called right now, but it was a jihadist document that essentially advocated a strong attack, particularly at the beginning, an attack on Spain, which would indeed have the result of ejecting Spain, of having Spain eject itself from the coalition in Iraq. And that is indeed eventually what happened. I mean, you're quite right that it wasn't a direct line, that the government was caught misrepresenting what happened. It's absolutely the case. But this has gone down in jihadist legend as a good example of an attack timed correctly that brought down a government. And indeed, that is what happened. You're quite right that the government, from their perspective, mishandled it. But indeed, it brought down the government, and it led to the pulling out of Spanish forces from Iraq. And of course, I was talking about that just as an example of an attack intended to affect an election in a sovereign country. And I think I was bringing it up in the context of my fears, my apprehensions, that you might have a series of attacks doing the same thing in the fall. Mm. And I say series because I think the thing that would really alter our domestic political situation would be one attack after another, several attacks on so-called soft targets. I mean, if you imagine for a second what would happen in the wake of perhaps a solitary person wandering into a McDonald's or a Starbucks and blowing themselves up, it would be an enormous story. Whether it would really benefit Trump in the end, whether he would be in a position by then to benefit, I mean, the campaign seems to be coming unglued, so who knows. But that is one of the things that I have been worried about. And I think that, the Islamic State people are very sophisticated. They attempt to affect politics around the world, and I think they're very aware of our election.
Well, thank you for calling in. And just to remind listeners, the bombs that ripped apart trains killed 191 people in Madrid in 2004, and 1,800 others were injured. So thanks again for calling in. Let's go next to Kay in San Francisco. Hi, Kay. Welcome to the show. Are we having phone problems today? Do we have Kay? All right, let me go to emails. Let's hear it from Kaveh in Oakland. He says, it's so refreshing to have this discussion. What do you think about the chain of events responsible for the creation of ISIS going back further than the invasion of Iraq, namely the CIA and British intelligence-sponsored 1953 coup of the democratically elected government of Iran, which led to a few decades of the Shah's rule, which led to the Iranian Revolution, which led to the Iran-Iraq War, leading to the Saddam invading Iran, and then the U.S. backing him. Kaveh writes, these interventions in the Middle East with our short-sighted follow-ups and blunders seem to have a very long tail of consequences that last decades.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Kaveh. You know, that history in Iran is, it's another example of something that is embedded in our public life in a very important way that most people are not aware of, that the United States and the British combined in 1953 to overthrow Mohammad Mossadegh's government and reinstall the Shah in his place. And that regime lasted for about 25 years before its overthrow by the forces of Ruhollah Khomeini in 78-79. And that was surely one of the large events looming over the Middle East to this day. Indeed, you know, the United States' invasion of Iraq, if you look at it in geostrategic or geopolitical terms, it led to Iraq's dominance might be too strong a word, but coming under the influence of Iran. Iraq, of course, is a majority Shia country that was ruled by a Sunni dictator, Saddam Hussein, and the American invasion led to a relative representative Shia government, which put Iraq under the sway of Iran and led to all sorts of unbalancing within the Middle East, not least the Syrian civil war.
And Mark, I just realized we are almost out of time.
Oh my.
I wish we had another hour. We're definitely going to have you back in a few months. Just quickly, what do you think the administration should do at this point? I know it's a big question.
Well, I think it should speak forthrightly to the American people, as President Obama commendably does. I think that our foreign policy should lead toward the surgical and limited use of violence, not the ever-widening use of violence. I think that insofar as we use drones, which we haven't talked about, but which have killed 5,000 people, probably, we should be using them in a much more limited fashion to try to limit our political, the politically widespread hatred of the United States. And I think the U.S. should probably be taking much more of a standoffish approach to the Middle East and letting it try to sort out the problems that, unfortunately, we have helped exacerbate there.
Mark Danner is a veteran journalist. His latest book is Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. And we will definitely have Mark back in a couple of months. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.